is determined by many factors. No one ought to underestimate in the determination of the Christian life the power of images, of metaphors, of dominant conceptions, of the general vision we have of what it is to be and to live as Christians. Now, this morning, what I want to do is to ask, what are the metaphors that determine the way we live as Christians? And what I want to do will not be exhaustive, but will be suggestive and in some measure arbitrary. There are a wide variety of images and metaphors and visions of the Christian life. In one sense, the Christian life is radically historical. There is no one way of being Christian, and in different historical contexts, people have been and are Christians in a variety of different ways. No one way exhausts the possibilities today. I had this put very vividly to me in 1951 when I was attending the Ecumenical Institute. Father Florovsky, who was a Roman Catholic priest and theologian, was there. Those were in the days when I had great optimism and hope about the public school. And Father Florovsky and I were discussing the relationship of public education to Christian faith. And Florovsky said to me, he said, the trouble with you Protestants is you identify Christian faith with public education. But he said there is not one single word in the New Testament about a public school system. Well, he was right. And he was right in his contention that you do not have to have public schools to be Christian. That has been demonstrated over and over again in the history of the Orthodox Church. Florovsky said to me that there is no concrete evidence that public education or universal education raises the level of Christian living. Well, maybe. But I attempted to say in reply to him, but very inadequately, as those of you who know Father Florovsky or knew Father Florovsky before his death can imagine, that may well be, and in the sight of God, the various forms of piety may be equally good, and the Eastern Orthodox piety may be even better embodiment of Christian faith, but no one can say there isn't a difference in which, in the way in which you're Christian, if out of your vision of the Christian life, education is an essential ingredient, or out of your vision of Christian life, education is not a fundamental ingredient in what it is to be and to do as Christians. Protestants, wherever they went, built schools beside their churches. And the consequence is that Protestant piety is very different from Eastern Orthodox piety. There are a great variety of ways in which we can be Christian. And these ways are determined in considerable measure by the metaphors, the visions, and the images that determine our thinking. Now, when we review some of these metaphors and images, one approach is the way of the question, what is the essence of Christian faith? Throughout the history of the church, there have been a number of theologians who have tried to answer in a very succinct way, what is it to be Christian? What, very briefly, very succinctly, does it mean to be a Christian? Now, certainly one of the most powerful statements of what it is to be a Christian a powerful statement whose power I am always impressed when I read the book anew after not having read it for a number of years. In Arif Hanok's book, What is Christianity? I had the experience in the early 60s. You know, Hanok went through an eclipse, and Hanok was the equivalent of bad theology in the theological orthodoxy of the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I remember assigning Hanok's book, What is Christianity, to a class to read in the early 60s, and he came as near creating a revival in that class, a spiritual revival, as anything I've ever assigned. And you know, it rather shook me up that this happened. But this is a very powerful statement. One can say that Hanok's What is Christianity, which were popular lectures that he gave in Berlin in 1900, is the finest and most influential statement of Christianity from the liberal perspective. And for Hanok, the essence of Christianity is three convictions. Number one, the kingdom of God and its coming. By kingdom of God, he meant the rule of God in the human heart. And secondly, God the Father and the infinite value of the human soul. This was the heart of it. And then third, the higher righteousness and the commandment of love. The essence of Christianity for Hanok was God the Father and the infinite value of each human being. Or as he put it otherwise, the fatherhood of God, as it was put in the slogans of the day, and the brotherhood of man. Now, the criticism that all the Bardian theology made of Hanok was that this was very superficial, and that this very benign reading of the facts of human existence would not stand up to the difficulties of the real world, symbolized in the First World War and the coming of the economic depression of the 1920s. And there's considerable, and that eclipsed Hanok, this understanding of Christian faith as trusting the Father in heaven and humaneness toward other human beings, love for other human beings. I was interested. I accidentally discovered one day the same answer to the question, what is the essence of Christianity, in the writings of MacLeod Campbell. MacLeod Campbell was that great Scottish preacher of the first half of the 19th century who wrote a very influential book on the atonement and is now undergoing a rather considerable theological revival at the University of Chicago and in Scotland, where theologians are always being resurrected. And right now, MacLeod Campbell is being resurrected. But the thing that was interesting in the passage that I ran upon in his writings was that he defined the essence of Christianity exactly as Hanok did, but he took as his sources the passion of Christ. And indeed, the passion of Christ upon the cross. And MacLeod Campbell said, if you really want to get to the heart of this matter, of what it is to be Christian, it is number one, to trust God. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And he said, secondly, it is love of neighbor. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And I thought when I read that in MacLeod Campbell, And here was the answer to the Neo-Reformation criticism of Harnack, what is Christianity? The Richelians in general. Harnack was a disciple of Albert Richel, and the social gospel movement people generally wanted to say that Christianity is this trust of the Heavenly Father and love of the neighbor. And I think we lose sight of this metaphor or image or vision of the Christian life at our peril. The problem arises, though, how do you balance the Christian life as trust in God and love for neighbor? This is always a very real problem. Some of you read Jeffrey Haddon's book, The Gathering Storm in the Churches, written in the 1960s when Haddon, who is now a sociologist at the University of Virginia, was a sociologist at Western Reserve University, and he analyzed the problem in the church. And based on one of the sociological studies of the Episcopal Church, he came to the conclusion that the Christian community is torn apart by those on the one hand who believe that the Christian gospel is exhausted in giving comfort to people, and those on the other hand who believe that the Christian gospel is exhausted in changing society. Now, I would say that became a real issue in the 60s. One could say that earlier the church had suffered from an overemphasis upon the gospel as exclusively a message of comfort. But in the 60s, one could say that the only orthodoxy, and since the mid-60s, one can say that the only real orthodoxy that the church knows is an orthodoxy on the transformation of society. Dietrich Richel, who taught at Pittsburgh Seminary, said that the only real orthodoxy in the United Presbyterian Church in the regard to the confession of 1967 was an orthodoxy on race. One could say the only really enforceable orthodoxy, even in the Presbyterian Church U.S. today, has to do with the ordination of women. Now, you can get yourself thrown out of presbytery or denied ordination if you object to the ordination of women as ministers, but I think you would have to be very clever, very ingenious, to get in trouble denying the deity of Jesus Christ or the resurrection or even the existence of God. This represents a radical change, and that's documentable. I mean, other than the Kaysman case, you give me illustration that would refute that. Here, the concern, whether Christianity is exhausted in loving the neighbor, or exhausted in the trust in God and the comfort of the gospel. Well, I think the answer to that, one can say, is that any Christianity that is not concerned with the establishment of justice, and any Christianity that does not express itself in love for neighbor, is fraudulent. But any Christianity that exhausts itself in the transformation of society is dead. And by the time you're 60, you realize that there are a great many things in life that are not going to be changed. And if Christianity does not have something more to say than the transformation of society, we are all, in the end, undone. It may be the passage of the years, but the older I get, the more I become convinced that the first and primary Christian witness is not love for neighbor, but trust in God and the serenity that this trust in God this trust in God distills from the raw stuff of life, and that actually in the end genuine love for neighbor, genuine openness to neighbor, is not possible apart from this trust in God. We are never to forget that life is an uphill battle, and in the end, we all lose. Unless there are resources of divine mercy and grace that can redeem us from destruction and put the broken pieces together again. Apart from trust in God, Christianity is dead. But without love for neighbor, a humaneness, a readiness to forgive, Christianity is fraudulent. Therefore, I think we are ill-advised when we throw out this very powerful statement of that liberal of all liberals, Harnack, when he attempted to say, what is Christianity? And came down on the fatherhood of God and the infinite value of each human being. Secondly, one can look at the Christian life in terms of metaphors that derive from its dynamic, the dynamics of the Christian life. And tying in with what I had to say yesterday, it seems to me that the metaphor of growth, the image of growth, is very important, particularly for those of us who are in the Christian, who are in the Reformed tradition. One can think of the Christian life primarily in terms of individual acts, discrete acts, God's command and the particular response to that particular command. But one can also think of the Christian life in terms of duration and growth in character, in terms of who one is, and not simply in terms of what one does. Now, of course, those two factors, what one does in the long run, helps to determine who one is, and who one is determines what one does. But where does the emphasis lie? Now, it seems to me that in the Calvinist tradition, the emphasis has to lie upon the metaphor and the image of growth. Or, as Al Voss would say next week, upon character. Character as our self-determination. A character that is formed by our intentions. A character that is very private. Because in the interior of our lives, we determine how we are going to see things and understand things and how we're going to respond to them. Character as it is reinforced through repeated and successful embodiments of intentions and acts. I mentioned yesterday that the dominant image, metaphor that Calvin used for the Christian life was the image of growth, the image of the military. The Christian is the soldier of the Lord in the conquest of the world, the flesh, and the devil. And Calvin was optimistic about what could be achieved. There are a great many pessimistic statements in Calvin, and Calvin became terribly discouraged. But Calvin, unlike Luther, thought history was going on for a long time, and he acted in any case as though a great many things can be accomplished in the history of individual persons and in the history of society. Now, when it comes to this measurement, is it possible? Daniel Day Williams once raised the question, is it possible to measure Christian growth? Now, once you raise that question, which would, as in light of what I said yesterday, would throw a Lutheran into a panic, once one raises that question, one subjects himself to herself to the danger of becoming overly fastidious about one's own spiritual temperature and health. All of us know people, though I suppose we know increasingly few people, who are overly fastidious about their own moral purity and who are overly concerned about how well they're doing in this business of being Christian. We ought to be able to relax, in a sense, and leave that to God. That we can learn from the Lutherans. But are there discernible ways in which we can measure growth in the Christian life? Well, I think it is possible to indicate certain ways in which we can measure growth without subjecting ourselves too much to the danger and the temptation to illusion. One is, certainly there is the capacity to grow in our ability to think in the light of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. To grow in our capacity to consciously relate our Christian faith to what we are doing in our profession or business, what we are doing in the political order. I mentioned yesterday that there was a great deal of difference between people who are in principle justificationists, but who are in practice sanctificationist, and people who are in principle sanctificationist and in practice justificationist. All of us have this kind of contradiction. But if you're dealing with a person who in principle at least admits that every human act falls short of the glory of God, then that we sin in our best deeds as well as our worst deeds, you at least have some kind of leverage that you do not have in the case of the people who are in principle sanctificationist and who think that they really are righteous on these very ambiguous and complex issues of our life. As Niebuhr liked to say, Protestants were in principle justificationists, but on the matter of tolerance were frequently in practice sanctificationists. On the matter of tolerance, certainly up until Vatican II, Roman Catholics were always in principle sanctificationists. They knew there was one true church and they were it. But in practice, they might be justificationists, knowing that among us sinners, differences are all very relative. Well, I think there is a possibility of measuring a certain growth, of recognizing a certain growth in our capacity to think as Christian people about what it means to live in the light of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ in vocation, in home, in business, etc. And as Calvinists, we always believe that as a person thinks, they will sooner or later act. And secondly, it seems to me it's possible to grow in terms of the means of grace. Arnold Toynbee, when he reflected on this matter of moral progress and growth in human history, I admitted that there was not much evidence of growth, but that one way in which you could measure growth was in the availability of the means of grace. And that, I think, is very true. And this is the problem for the church in making available the means of grace, about which we talked the other day, the means which the Holy Spirit uses to apply the redemption wrought by Christ, to use the traditional language, to transform our lives and to remake us in the image of Christ. And the availability of the means of grace have a great deal to do with the Christian health of our society as well as our individual health. And we apply that today in an increasingly free society, voluntary church, and a free, pluralistic, secular, mobile, urban, mass media-dominated social order where the sanctions, the props, even the means of grace are not imposed upon us as they were when I was a child. Now, in these two areas, it seems to me it's possible for us to think very concretely and very specifically about Christian growth in our capacity to think, in the time we give to thinking, in our acknowledgement of the obligation to think as Christians about the issues of the day, in the means of grace. And I would include in that the documentable ways of such things as grace at the table. Incidentally, that same study that the Episcopalians had made in the 60s indicated a radical decline in the practice of saying a prayer at the beginning of a meal. That was the last bit of the older Protestant piety that succumbed to the secularization of life, but there had been a surprising decrease in the habitual utterance of a prayer when the family gathers to eat a particular meal. These very specific means of grace, it seems to me, we can measure growth. Now, when we move beyond this, it seems to me that the measurement of any kind of growth in the Christian life becomes much more difficult and much more dangerous. But surely it is appropriate for us to ask ourselves in introspection, in any case, to critically ask ourselves, are we growing in our capacity to respond in love to the impact of other persons' lives upon our lives? Or secondly, are we growing in our capacity to handle the crises and the challenges of life as those who trust in the living God? And as I've already said, perhaps it's my age, but that becomes increasingly, for me, a fundamental touchstone of Christian piety and living. Our capacity to handle and to respond to the challenges and crises of life as those who trust in the living God. Well, certainly with Calvin, the concept of growth was very important. He said over and over again, we ought to be a better Christian today than we were last month or a year ago or 10 years ago. And whether or not we think of the Christian life in terms of character, the duration, the consistency, the reliability of our personal existence, or whether we think of it more specifically in terms of growth, makes a great deal of difference over against those who think of the Christian life primarily in terms of the spontaneous act and response to a specific command of God. Now, let us come a step further. And here I'll get on more common ground, I think. One of the most common images of the Christian life, at least in the Protestant piety in which I grew up, was the image of command. Command and obedience. I was appalled in my own life to see this documented so clearly. I wrote a Covenant Life curriculum book in 1963 in the Covenant Life curriculum, and I was talking about what it is to live in the church. And I had a chapter on what it is to believe, what it is to be a Presbyterian, and then I had a chapter on the church obeys. The church worships, the church obeys, the church hopes. And when I read that chapter on obedience to revise the book 2 years ago, I realized how radically I had interpreted the Christian life specifically in terms of command and obedience. And I had a very difficult time of trying to revise it. If any of you have used that revision of that book, you can see the contradictions in it. Well, of course, there's a good reason for that. Calvin thought of the Christian life in large measure, it seems to me, as command and obedience in terms of law. The Christian life is the law of God and obedience to that law. Now, I think my colleague Charles Sweezy would argue, and I think probably correctly, that Calvin had no other conceptuality, that he was limited here in the conceptualities that were available to him, and that what Calvin actually meant by command, law, and obedience was obligation. But I couldn't figure, and he advised me to change that chapter and say the church is obligated, but that sounded a little awkward. So I just kept it, the church obeys, and tried to revise it more in another way. But in the popular piety of the Presbyterian Church, this imagery of the Christian life in terms of law and obedience, command and obedience, and in particular, under the metaphor of an army officer giving the command and a private obeying, this was prevalent in the piety of the church. It was certainly prevalent in the piety of the community in which I grew up, in the church in which I grew up. And the, as I said, the imagery of command and obedience was further sharpened concerning the analogy of an army officer barking out a command and the private heaving too. Now, this leads in the Christian life to legalism. Now, I hesitate to berate legalism. I don't run into too many legalists around today. That's one problem in talking about theology in our time. You have such a radically different group, and what you say in one group means something different from what it would mean in another group. But there is such a thing as legalism. And legalism falls short of Christian faith for certain very specific reasons. One is that legalism is always very superficial. It is always on the surface of life. We know people who keep all the laws who are as mean as the devil himself. And therefore, legalism always falls short of the Christian faith. It falls short because it cannot anticipate the possibilities of human freedom. There's no way a law can anticipate the possibilities that are open in the light of the freedom of the human spirit. And thirdly, legalism is never adequate to deal with the complexities, with all the factors that are involved in most moral decisions. Except for the very simple decisions of life, most moral decisions are very complex. And we do not have the option between the simple good and the simple evil. We have to choose the more or less good and the more or less evil to do the best we can and trust God to forgive us if we are wrong. We have to make decisions in many cases before all the facts are in. The worst problem with legalism is that it is always in the end. Legalists are always in the end self-righteous, and they're always in the end brutal. The danger is not only legalism, but one may also say moralism. Moralism and legalism are closely related. But here I would suggest that by moralism we can mean an insistence upon a particular rule or a particular value at the expense of other rules and other values and without regard for the complexity of the human situation. I had a very interesting discussion at the University of Virginia, the White Miller Burkett Center of Government and Public Affairs. I had a very interesting discussion on moralism in foreign affairs, and they brought in a great many experts and practitioners of foreign relations, and they attempted to define what it is to be a moralist in foreign relations. Sometimes heard Jimmy Carter was a moralist, or Dulles was a moralistic practitioner of foreign affairs. What does it mean to be a moralist? And their conclusion was that moralism is the, in foreign affairs at any rate, is the centering upon one value that you are going to maintain with purity and integrity without regard for any other value or without regard for the complexity of the human situation. In Carter's case, the attempt in the beginning to hold to the value of human rights apart from any other values or any other complex factors. Well, I don't think one can eliminate the metaphor of command and obedience. The law, at the least, always represents the wisdom of the human race. And it always contributes to ethical decision making and to the formation of Christian character. But the point I want to make is that if that is the dominant image that we have of the Christian life, it's going to lead to, it seems to me, a very truncated form of Christian piety. Now, Calvin's emphasis upon this particular image was supplemented by another image that was exceedingly important for Calvin, and I cannot decide for myself whether the image of law and obedience takes precedence or whether it is subordinate to the image of the fulfillment of the purposes of God. The Christian life as the embodiment of the purposes of God. Anyone who's come up in traditional Presbyterianism has heard about the decrees of God. Well, decrees is a word that really doesn't mean very much to us today, but if you substitute the word purpose of God, you'll be very close to what the 17th century theologians meant when they spoke about the decrees of God. Certainly for Calvin, one of the dominant way, if not the dominant way, in which he conceived the Christian life was the embodiment, at least in a partial and fragmentary way, in ordinary human experience, in home, in business, in society, of the eternal purposes of God. Calvin began with the concept of God as energy, activity, and power. Our dominant images of the Christian life always root in our theology And the Calvinists always begin their thought of God not as the truth, not as the absolute, not as the great mathematician, not as beauty, and all of these failures to emphasize these particular aspects of the being of God. Edwards, of course, did emphasize beauty, but that was a later Calvinist. The thing that is clear in all the Calvinists is the primary emphasis upon God as energy, as activity, as intentionality, as moral purpose and will, the creator and the preserver of the universe, who is actively working out the divine purposes in time and in space. And this is the reason the doctrine of predestination did not lead to quietism for Calvin, nor for the Calvinist, because the God who elects, this active God who is the Lord of earth and of history, elects us to embody his purposes in the concrete events of our own lives and in the society of which we are a part. Calvin conceived the Christian life in terms of the fulfillment of the purposes of God in the great dramas of human history. He was concerned not simply that individuals in Geneva should be Christian, but that Geneva should be Christian, that here the purposes of God should be established, and that the kingdom of God should increasingly come on earth. And wherever the Calvinists went, they carried with them this vision of the Christian God, working out his purposes in human history. They carried with them this vision of the Christian commonwealth, this image of the Christian life in terms of the fulfillment of the purposes of God in the great dramas of human history. They took it to Scotland, and they transformed Scotland from a rude, crude country to one known for piety and for learning. The Puritans sought to establish the New Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land, and the Puritans who landed in Massachusetts went on an errand into the wilderness to demonstrate to the decaying society of Europe the possibility of embodying the divine purposes in a concrete social order. This was the vision, and of course it never fully came off. And there was a great deal of embarrassment when it didn't come off. The Calvinist saints had their chance in the 1640s in the Puritan Revolution, and it didn't come off as they had hoped. And therefore Milton, who had shared this vision, had to write an explanation of why the saints failed, as they always do fail, in Paradise Lost. And one of the great monuments of Reformed faith and literature is Paradise Lost. But it's followed by another great monument of Reformed faith and literature, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And the dominant image in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is not the fulfillment of the purposes of God in the great dramas of history, but the lonely pilgrimage through this veil of tears to the celestial city. Because Bunyan was in jail and the saints had failed. Now, who can say which is the more authentic Christian piety? But there are different images of the piety here. When the saints never fully produced the Christian community, you had the rise of pietism, which defined the Christian life in terms of one's personal existence and in terms of one's personal relationship to God. Who is a Christian? A Christian is a person who says prayers in the morning and prayers in the evening, who doesn't get drunk, who doesn't use profanity, who reads the Bible, who goes to church, who pays the bills, etc. Christian faith is determined here in terms of personal piety. And it says nothing to say about the fulfillment of the purposes of God in the transformation of society, either society in America today, or taking, they say, Bismarck. I've read that Bismarck was a model Christian in his parlor, but when he went to the Foreign Affairs Office, it was blood and iron. This definition of the Christian life in terms of personal piety. Now, one ought not to depreciate that. If you happen to be a Christian in East Germany today, I'm not sure there's any other way to be a Christian in East Germany, except in terms of this kind of personal piety, or in Russia today. The way in which we're Christian, radically determined by our historical situation. I'm also convinced that another embodiment of this image of being what it is to be Christian this came a substitute for the embodiment of the will of God in the social order, in the dramas of history, was concern for evangelism and church membership. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood, and I'm going to quit, so I didn't say in some way to ask questions, so I want to quit here, but I do want to say that it seems to me that the response to the failure of the saints to establish the New Jerusalem and the difficulties embodied in the model of the Christian life in terms of the fulfillment of the purpose of God, the reaction was, number one, in pietism, number two, in evangelism, in plucking souls from the burning. Now, I don't want to depreciate that. Every year, one of the rituals I go through is to look at the statistical report of the Minister of General Assembly. And anyone who looks at the statistical report of Presbyterian churches in the last 15 years can only come away with a very heavy heart and with very great concern about the future and a great realization that many of us in the church are living parasitically upon what other people have done, and that we're rapidly, if we were in a business, we would know that we're rapidly going broke. So I don't want to depreciate it, but I do want to say that this represents a modification of the dominant vision of the Calvinist of the embodiment of the Christian life in terms of the fulfillment of the purposes of God. Now, the question is, how do you conceptualize that in the kind of society in which we live in today? How would you conceptualize it in Russia? How do you conceptualize it in a highly pluralistic, secular, mobile, mass media-dominated society in America? The people who established the church in which I grew up as a boy in South Carolina, they were generals in the Revolutionary Army, and they put five churches in that area, 13 miles apart. They intended for that to be a Presbyterian community. Now, the Baptists and Methodists undercut them, and they didn't get it pulled off, but it was still Protestantdom. But today, no one would think of carving out a Presbyterian community or even a Christian community. But perhaps there is some way creatively we can recover this vision of the fulfillment of the purposes of God in human history. In any case, the Calvinist, I think, can never be happy simply with a pietistic model of the Christian life or with evangelism as a model of the Christian life. Now, I'm going to stop at that point, and tomorrow I'm going to go on with the the imitation of Christ, and the metaphor of a person made free by Christ, before I move into the theme, the Christian hope, which we had for tomorrow.